My name is Eve, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. Very glad to be here. This has been a wonderful weekend. I hate it when people are so loving and wonderful when they introduce you. It's all right, maybe afterwards, but beforehand, it sort of sets you like, oh, God. Is that really me? Am I going to be that good? I don't know. But this has been an absolutely wonderful weekend. I've loved every minute of it. The meetings have been absolutely spectacular. And the show last night was something super. Got it all together, the awards. I think that should get a reward along with golf and tennis, only even better. Because it was reflecting of AA and a tremendous amount of work and effort on the part of the people who were involved to share in AA with the rest of us. I certainly thoroughly enjoyed it. As a matter of fact, the whole thing started out like a terrific thing, because look at the program. The program was absolutely wonderful. In the first place, they didn't consult me, but they used all my favorite sections of the book. They've got the promises in here. They've got that wonderful line from the family afterward. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And God knows we've done that this weekend, I think. I certainly have enjoyed myself. And then at the end, they have got part of the wonderful chapter 11, A Vision for You. Abandon yourself to God, and so forth. So that set the tone as far as I was concerned. I knew it was going to be a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And the opportunity to see some friends of old, because I've been here a couple of times before, and I chose the contacts that I'm able to make when I'm on these trips and have a chance to renew old friends and old acquaintances and make new ones, which I hope I've done this time. I think the speaker last night said so many things that are true of all of us. When he was talking about his early life and the way he felt, I'm sure I identified with him, and I think a lot of you undoubtedly did too. Because I think that's part of what we face, and that is the fact that we have to look back at our situation in reference to drinking and finally come to the conclusion that if alcohol provided that magic for us, we better look at it. We might have a problem. Because that's what made Sandy feel okay. When he had a drink, he felt like a whole person. He said that it made people around him change. That's an interesting way of looking at it. As far as I'm concerned, it made me change. But of course, that's because I never bothered with looking at other people. I was totally looking at myself. Never looked at anybody else, as far as I can remember. And so I just love AA, and I think we all do. But I love not just the steps, I love the whole process. I love the whole structure. I love the traditions. I love the things that bind us together. I love the fellowship, of course. But I'm so grateful for those people who went before us and who left a structure that is going to help us not to self-destruct. Because Bill often used to say that. The only fear I have for Alcoholics Anonymous is that it will destroy itself from within. And as long as we abide by the traditions and the steps and keep our minds on service and the 12 concepts, as Willie mentioned yesterday in that lovely meeting yesterday afternoon, I think we are protected. But just the process alone somehow to me seems absolutely fascinating. I mean, if you look at the way it works, you know, you get into a situation where you've got to talk to somebody. I know as far as I was concerned, I did that. And it was wonderful because I began to feel that sense of identification right away. And that's why I love speaker meetings. I got sober on speaker meetings. In Florida, where I live, I love it. But AA isn't exactly the way I wish it were. But I'm staying sober in it. A lot of other people are too. But they have only discussion meetings. And I don't get that identification with a discussion meeting. I find it very, I never ask any of my girls that are new to start going to discussion meetings. I don't think it's very helpful to go into a meeting where they're going to talk all evening about relationships. You know, I think we ought to put more pressure on how it works. And of course they read that, but you know, that isn't really working either. So I'm one of those people who, like Sandy, for whom alcohol was magic at the very beginning. I didn't realize it at the time, of course. I knew it was something spectacular, but I didn't understand what it was going to be all about. I had feelings of guilt and discomfort and low self-esteem and all those things very early on. My mother died when I was 12, And I had two sisters who were absolutely beautiful. And I grew very fast, and I was about 5'9". God has shrunk me a little in these later years. And so I was the biggest, and very broad shoulders, and this huge nose, and all elbows and knees, and very awkward and homely. And I had these two beautiful sisters. It really wasn't fair. I mean, just one of them could have been homely, too, but they were both beautiful, and it made it very hard for me. And I never felt I belonged. I always felt apart from, instead of a part of. I was self-conscious, terribly self-conscious. And eventually, as I grew older, I decided to say that I was shy, because I felt so shy. And I always think shy is kind of sweet, you know, sort of vulnerable and feminine and dear, you know. And Pat Wise knocked that out of me a couple of years ago. And she said that when she got sober, they told her that shy was total self-obsession. And I realize now, of course, that that's what it was. But at the time, I felt that I was shy. And I had great difficulty in growing up. I had difficulty in relating to people and communicating. And it was just, life seemed too hard for me. Maybe things would have been different if I had a mother, I don't know. But my father didn't want me to bob my hair as everybody else did. And he wouldn't let me use makeup. And I was only 14 and in a junior class, so, you know, everybody else around me was getting sophisticated and grown up and so forth. So that made me uncomfortable. But the worst feeling I had was this awful feeling of guilt. Because when my mother died, I don't remember anything about her, really, except I remember standing in front of her coffin. And I don't remember whether it was open. It undoubtedly was, because of the time. It was in 1920. It undoubtedly was open at that time. But I remember saying to my father, "Where's my baby brother?" And they said, "Well, he's at the bottom of the coffin, dear." And then all I could think of was, gee, maybe the kids at school will be nicer to me because my mother just died. And as I grew older, I had such a sense of shame and guilt that I would have had that thought instead of sadness and sorrow that I had lost my mother. And I think that was an indication, as I look back at it, of how very sick I was and how totally self-obsessed I was during my growing up years. I went off to college when I was 16. I was no more ready to go to college than a man on the moon. My marks were all right, but I mean, I was not socially adjusted well enough to be able to go to college. And I hated the thought of going there. I was terrified. I have to keep doing that because I have dry mouth from radiation therapy. Don't buy the tapes because I'm always slurping in them, you know, slurp. Slurp. Anyhow, when I went up to Vassar College, which is a nice old college in the East, I went up there and entered college when I was 16, in the year 1924. I'll add it for you. I'm 84 now. Saves time. And my father took me up there and was going to leave me, and I begged him to take me home. I said, "I can't stand it. I've been out to my room," and I'd met my roommate. And she was terribly, terribly Greenwich, Connecticut. I don't know how to describe that here. I guess Palm Springs would do. I think Palm Springs would fit it. But in any event, I really didn't want to stay, and I begged my dad to take me home. He said, "Honey, you're a big girl." I knew I was a big girl. God, they'd been to... Anyhow, I went back upstairs to my room and found that my roommate had requested a transfer. Well, I want to tell you, I went absolutely into the depths of despair. Total rejection. I knew nobody would like me. I knew I shouldn't be here. I knew I shouldn't belong. Nobody's going to like me. I'm not good enough. I don't know how to deal with things. And then my new roommate walked in. And she had long, greasy, brown hair, glasses, 5 stacks of books. I knew she was a grind, as we used to say. And I looked at her, and I tell this story because to me it is so indicative of the way I felt for so many years. From despair to something quite different. I looked at her, and inside myself I said, "But I deserve better than this." And that change from one minute feeling abject to the next minute being as arrogant as hell, I never could understand that till I got to AA and began to work on the fourth step and began to know me. Because I never did know me during all those years. I hated myself. I thought I was useless and worthless. I was homely, unattractive. I didn't know how to deal with people. I was self-obsessed, shy, really shy, you know. And so my years there were not exactly exciting. I didn't drink. This is during Prohibition, of course. And everybody else was drinking out of the hip flask and all that kind of thing. And I somehow was afraid of drinking. I really had a fear. I'd seen people do nutty things and all the rest of it. And I somehow didn't want to lose control. I didn't realize that's the way I felt, but I realize it now. I didn't want to lose control. And of course, I never realized how important having control of everything was going to be to me in my later years. But anyhow, I knew I was going to go to Europe at the end of my sophomore year, because back in those days, every self-respecting father who could possibly manage to find the money sent his girl to Europe on a tour. And I knew I was going to do that at the end of my sophomore year, so I decided that I would wait until I went to Europe, and then I would drink as Europeans did. You know, graciously, a little wine with my meals, instead of all this hip flask routine that was going on around me at that time. And so I got on the ship and we went abroad. We didn't fly. Of course, there weren't any airplanes then. Oh, my God, I've lived a long time. Anyhow, we got on board and we didn't wait till we got to Europe, because they started serving 12 miles out. And somebody asked me what I wanted to drink, and I didn't know, but the person next to me, I have no idea whether it was a man or a woman. We were very well chaperoned, so it was probably a woman. But anyhow, she ordered an orange blossom, and I didn't know any better, so I ordered an orange blossom. And it was wonderful. That was when the magic happened. Because when I drank that wonderful orange blossom, everything changed. All of a sudden, I was 5'2", eyes of blue, and adorable. And one more orange blossom, and I was witty. I could talk to people. I could communicate. And so I realized much later on, after I got sober in AA, that I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. But of course, I didn't realize that then. I thought that I had found a magic elixir that was going to help me live. Because I used it. I used alcohol from then on to cope. I used it to cope with problems, to cope with life, to cope with love, to cope with my husband, to cope with everything. And I really thought that I couldn't live without it. Now, of course, I didn't drink all the time back then. I drank too much upon occasion. I used to get high and tight when I shouldn't have. But nobody would look at me and say, that young lady is an alcoholic, you know. Nobody thought about alcoholism in those days. Young people, look at the young people today that are coming in. It's just absolutely wonderful. Now, whether or not I would have been ready to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic when I was 17, I don't know. But it is wonderful that we are beginning to look at it at an earlier age and accepting the fact that it can be there at an early age. Instead of saying, as they used to when I first got sober, hell, kid, go on out and drink some more. Hell, I've spilled more than you drank, you know. Because that's what they used to do. And there was one wonderful guy in New York who came in when he was about 24, and he lasted 2 years because everybody kept saying he was too young to be an alcoholic. So he went out and got drunk and came back when he was about 35. A few wasted years there. So anyhow, I got back and I went back to college and decided I could be very popular and so forth because I was going to drink. And I did, and I got caught by drinking on the campus. I got caught every time I did anything naughty. I never got away with anything. My sister used to get away with murder, but I never got away. Anyhow, I was expelled. And I was terribly, terribly guilty about that because I saw it let my family down. My mother graduated from Vassar in 1903. My sister was due to come into class the following year, and here I'd been expelled. I was the black sheep of the family, and I was just full of guilt and remorse. But somehow I couldn't do that to my father. I couldn't say, oh, Dad, I'm so sorry. I couldn't do it. I had to defend myself some way. I had to be on the defensive. And so I said to him, you know, Dad, this place is perfectly terrible. I wouldn't have stayed anyhow, even if they hadn't fired me. I was going to get the hell out because this place is full of birds. I said, besides, I know what I want to do with my life. And he said, well, what's that? And I said, well, you know, I've always wanted to be an actress. Well, he said, okay. And, of course, I thought that's what I wanted to do. I had thought that for years. My father was a playwright. My uncle was a famous actor, manager, and star. And I had got theater in my blood, as far as that's concerned. And so he said, okay. And so he called up a prominent director and said, my daughter wants to get some training for the theater. So he said, send her up to Skowhegan, which was a summer theater back in those days, very prominent one up in Maine. So I went up to Skowhegan and played all summer. Then my uncle gave me a job in his company, and I had a nice job there. So everything was handed to me on a silver platter. And I just loved it. I loved being in the theater. But of course, I didn't really want to be an actress. I mean, I realized that when I got to AA, too. So much that we don't know about ourselves, and that's one of the wonderful parts about this program, that we can finally begin to know who we are. And as a result of that, learn to like ourselves. In fact, we can even love ourselves, and should. But of course, I didn't know that then. Because I realize now that my whole goal of being an actress was to get to be a star with my name in lights and people coming up and telling me how wonderful I was. And I think, you know, I felt that if ever other people thought I was wonderful, maybe I could be wonderful. Maybe I could think I was wonderful. And I think a lot of us that way. I mean, most of us are perfectionists and striving to do things super, super. I never did 12-step anybody who said their goal was to be the second best secretary and the second best football player. And you know, I get real mad sometimes, especially during the Olympic years. When they talk about winning the gold medallion or whatever it is that they win. You know, it's all wonderful. And then they say, well, Susie Q won the silver. Oh, really? Yeah. Only the second best in the whole goddamn world, and they're not going to pay any attention to her.
Right.
Right? I agree. Anyhow, I did get expelled, and I did go into the theater, and I had some exciting times, some wonderful times, but I drank. And I look back and I realize how two different people I was. Talking about schizophrenia and maybe having some basis in, or alcoholism sometimes having some basis in schizophrenia. I was like two totally different people. When I was drinking, I was all over the place. We were on tour for two or three years during the early 30s, during the Depression. Our company was the only one that was touring throughout the country at that time. And when I was drinking, I was in the car with all the guys and jumping from bunk to bunk and talking and drinking and, you know. And when I'd go on the water wagon, because I'd gotten a little warning about I'd better not get on stage with a little too much to drink again, I would stop drinking entirely and go on the water wagon. And when I was on the water wagon, I'd sit in the back of one of the cars. We had a private train with a book of Jean Christophe, which if you remember is a very big book. And I would read, never talk with anybody. I was like a totally different person. However, that didn't last, because eventually my uncle was very kind. He said to me, darling, I'm terribly sorry, but we don't have enough big parts for you next year. And that satisfied my poor little ego, and so I stopped being a great star. And for a little while, I didn't know what I was going to do. I forgot to mention that I had started doing something else that we do, I think. I started getting married. And I had a lovely boy, a lovely son as a result of that marriage, but that marriage went by the boards after a year or two. And so there I was sort of running around, not really knowing what I wanted to do with my life, really terrified, full of fear, and recognizing that fear for the first time. Up until then, I had covered my fear with arrogance, as we so often do. We put up such a front and act like everything's okay. And I didn't know how to cope with these terrible feelings that I had of failure and lack of success and unable to follow through and inadequacy and all that kind of never enough of anything and I was never going to amount to anything and all those terrible fears and that nobody would love me and oh my God, I wanted love so badly. I desperately wanted somebody to love me. I wanted to be appreciated and to be approved of. I needed to be approved of. And I needed somebody to keep telling me that I was okay, because I didn't think I was. But anyhow, during that time, I was drinking, of course, and partying and so forth. And I kind of recall every now and then a little thing that happened a little earlier. I had taught myself how to smoke before I went to college, because I thought that would make me appear very sophisticated if I could smoke. And I used to even practice with a great holder, long holder, so that I would look sophisticated. And so forth. And I went to visit my Methodist grandmother up in New Britain, Connecticut one weekend. And she'd never seen me smoke before, and she was terribly upset. And she said, my dear. And she used to drum her fingers on the side of the old rocker that she sat in. He said, "My dear, smoking leads to drinking, and drinking leads to prostitution." I never got paid. And eventually I found the man of my dreams. He was the man of my dreams because he drank the same way I did. I thought he was absolutely wonderful. And he thought I was. And we really didn't love each other. But of course, the basis of our relationship was booze. That was what got us together. Bed and booze, you know. But we did care. And I thought we were going to have a wonderful marriage because of that. But didn't know that we both were alcoholics. Neither one of us knew that. And we couldn't have this wonderful life because of the alcohol. Only we didn't recognize it at the time. And so we started our married life. My son came to live with us, and I was joyous to have him back with us at that time. He was about 4 or 5. And then we eventually had 2 beautiful daughters of our own. And I adored my children. I just adored them. And, of course, they're the ones I hurt the most, especially my son, because he was getting older and was recognizing the problem more than the little ones did. And it was really bad. It's very difficult with 2 alcoholics, both of them, living together. Because, unfortunately, they helped to bolster one another's alibi and denial. Because we're always going to blame somebody else or something else for our situation. We're never going to take responsibility for our own actions. At least I never did. And so I could always look at him, you know, well, he's the problem. And people used to come up to me and say, "Evie, you're drinking so much more than you used to." And I'd say, "Oh, no, it's that son of a bitch I'm married to. I couldn't stand living with him if I didn't drink with him." And so I blamed him. And probably he blamed me. Well, except for the fact I don't think he ever thought about it. He just drank and drank and drank. And he was never worried about his drinking, never bothered him, and he never got sick. Now, I used to get terribly sick after a 3-week binge when I couldn't, you know, get off of it. And then I would pray the next day that it would stay down. And I would break myself around that china. Oh, and just pray that this one would stay down so that I could begin to heal. And he never felt sick that way. He used to say to me, "If I ever got sick like you do, I'd do something about my drinking." But I it took me some time. My little girls, of course, were being hurt. My sins of omission were greater than my sins of commission, I'm sure. But nonetheless, there was damage done. And it's one of the things I think we gals have to really work on when we get sober, to get over the guilt and recognize the fact that we did the best we could with the way we were. Because we were sick and we were trying. We never deliberately tried to hurt anybody. At least I don't think most of us did. But as I say, the sins of omission, leaving them alone when things could have happened to them, but thank God they didn't. And recognizing that helped me a little bit to come to a better understanding of the higher power when I got to AA. The fact that some terrible things could have happened to my children and didn't. And there must have been a power greater than myself that was protecting them. And so that helped me. I read the Jack Alexander article in 1941, and I thought, wouldn't that be wonderful for Roger? Because if Roger would join this thing, whatever it is, looks interesting, why then I wouldn't have a problem. But Roger was not the slightest bit interested. He did not care to join that thing. And I was so full of fear and so terrified of everything that I didn't dare try and go by myself. At that time, I didn't really think I needed it. I thought he did. But, of course, eventually the time was going to come when I knew that I did. I can remember one day, my older little girl was 4, I think, and she was going to nursery school. And this is during the war years. I had no help. We had no money. Of course, we had no money. How could we, with both of us drinking the way we were? But my husband was unemployable in his early employment. He had been, like our friend Dell here, a famous radio announcer. But I didn't realize he was unemployable at the time. I got married to him and was working for his folks in a little chimney business for $25 a week. So you can see money wasn't flowing in. But anyhow, the older little girl went to nursery school, and one morning I looked at her, and I was in terrible shape, terrible. And I never wanted to drink in the morning. I always kept putting it off. And the result was I made myself suffer at the tortures of the dam, because I kept thinking, I've got to stop. And I'd be shaking and falling apart and terrified that I was going to go off my rocker or something. And I felt like that this morning, and I said to Ruthie, I looked at her, and I said, was four, and I said, honey, do you mind going to school by yourself, going down to pick up the school bus this morning, get down in the lobby by yourself, alone? And she looked at me and said, do I have to? And she had the biggest yellow eyes I've ever seen, still does. And I couldn't bear it, so I bolted the drink, and I went down to the lobby with her with dark glasses on. I had black eyes, and I was covering it up, and I was trying not to look so anybody would catch my breath. And I watched her get on that little bus, said goodbye. And I stood there, and I thought to myself, what's happened to me? What has happened to me? I seem to have lost something. I seem to have lost my feeling of doing anything, because alcohol has gotten so important to me. I seem to have lost my sense of integrity, my moral values. I don't know what's wrong with me. I've lost my way. And it was the beginning of an awareness. I'd had that awareness, but I could keep pointing at Roger. And when I began to look at myself, I began to recognize that this was a problem, that perhaps I had too. Anyhow, time went on, and a couple of years later, or a year or so later, my mother-in-law came to visit us, and she was upset because we were both drunk. And she left after a day, and she left a note which said, my dear children, the world frowns upon inebriates. Inebriates? If you don't like the word alcoholic, try inebriates. We're going to have a whole new fellowship, inebriates illuminated. Anyhow, she said, I've written to the Alcoholic Foundation, which is the forerunner of the General Service Board, as you know. And she said, I've written to them and asked them to send you some literature. And the literature arrived a day or so later. And there was a little pamphlet that had a story, one story of a woman. And I read that, and I thought, there's one woman somewhere in this world that feels like I do, feels the way I do, reacts the way I do. And it gave me hope. But I was terrified to go alone. And I begged Roger to go with me, and he still wouldn't go. And I was so full of fear. It's so ridiculous, because what is there? You know, I was afraid of people. And it took me in AA a little time to understand that it wasn't that I was afraid of you, that you were going to knock me down or kill me or anything. I was afraid of what you were going to think of me. Would you approve of me? Would you like me? You know. And that felt an obsession again. And so I didn't go, and I needed to go desperately. But finally the day came when I could no longer stand myself. I had promised my son. He had looked at me one day and said, Mommy, I can't stand to come home and watch you get drunk every night. He was 14 years old. And I was frantic. His eyes were full of hurt, fear, bewilderment, distrust. I didn't see any love there. And it terrified me. And I told him I knew I was an alcoholic, because by that time I'd made my decision that I knew that. But I said, I promise you I'll never drink again, but more than that, I'll promise if I can't do it alone, I'll go to AA, even if Roger won't go. And so I went off to the summer, for the summer with the children. We had a little shack up in Connecticut for the summer. It was a real shack. We didn't, there was no running water, and pump that you could pump in the kitchen, and a lovely outhouse. The one holer. And of course I drank, because I was terrified of being alone in the country. I was a city girl, and being alone in the country frightened me. I drank. When I got home back to New York in September, I tried so hard to stop drinking. I never tried harder in my life. I wanted to stop more than I wanted anything in the world, and I couldn't stop. And so finally I called AA. And they asked me to come on down to the old clubhouse, and I got the address, 324 and a half, West 24th Street. And I got down there on the bus, frightened to death, had two or three drinks to get me there. And I began talking to somebody down there. Well, I stood outside for a few minutes because I was afraid to go in. And there was this dark hallway, but at the end of the hallway I could see light, and I could hear voices, and there was a big room up there. And I could see that light, and I could hear that laughter. And I finally went down that hole, and I discovered later that they called it the last mile. That was the name that they gave it. So I walked into that room and began to talk with a guy who began to talk to me. And he began telling me about himself. As I look back at it now, I can see the magic of AA, the way it works from the very beginning. because he told me about the things he did. Oh, I thought, I never did that. And a little bit of guilt would run away, just a little. Then he'd say something more. I think, gee, I never did that. Maybe I can join. Maybe they'll let me join. I was so afraid. I was so terrible. They wouldn't let me come in. And so every time he'd tell me something that he'd done and I hadn't done it, I was so grateful because I thought that would make it possible for me to really join. And he was just wonderful. And I told him a little bit about myself, not much, but I told him a little, and finally it was time for me to go. And I started to go, and I thought, God, he's been so wonderful. I've got to be honest with him. Oh, dear. So I turned back to him, and I said, Dan? Yes, he said. I said, I've got to tell you something else. Well, he said, what is it? I'm sure he thought I was going to confess to murder. I said, I have an inferiority complex. And they all, what you did. And he yelled over to a group at another table and said, this babe says she's got an inferiority complex. They laughed. And you know what I did? Son of a bitch, I'm going out of here. But he grabbed my hand and said, you'll do. And I went to a meeting the following Saturday. It took me 5 days to really get myself off of it. And I went to a meeting on Saturday night. It was an open meeting at the old Hotel Capitol. The group had grown, so they couldn't have a big speaker meeting in the little clubhouse anymore. There were too many of us. And so they had this big meeting at the Hotel Capitol at 8th Avenue and 50th Street, long since been torn down. And I stood outside that meeting with that same feeling of fear, and I went inside and did exactly the same thing I'd done at college. I'm standing outside, terrified of going in. I don't think they'll like me. I won't belong. Oh, dear, why not? And my husband didn't like the idea of my going to AA. I guess I was his drinking partner, and he didn't like losing me. But it was very, very difficult, because he didn't help me much with my self-esteem, because I remember once he looked at me and said, you know, you're the homeliest goddamn woman I ever knew. And, of course, I thought I was anyway, so that didn't help. And then he said, listen, one meeting a week, that's all you've got. I'm not going to stay home with the kids while you go with those people. He said, one meeting a week. So I only had one meeting a week. And I see today, and I saw then, people stopping off at other people's homes, having coffee and sharing and all the rest of it. And I didn't have that wonderful opportunity to do that, which may be one of the reasons why I was such a slow learner, such a dummy, because I really was very slow at getting this program. I loved the slogans. Somebody talked about the slogans at the meetings here the last couple of days. Incidentally, those daytime panels have been absolutely fantastically marvelous. They set a very high standard for the rest of the speakers. I don't know why you bother to have us come in when you've got speakers like that right here in your home yard. Anyhow, I'm glad I'm here. Sort of. So I began to go to meetings, and as I said, I just fell in love with it. And I love the slogans. Easy does it. That was my favorite. Easy does it. Easy does it. Every time something terrible would happen, I would just jump in there and say, easy does it. I wasn't going to drink. Damn it, I wasn't going to drink. And I walked into that AA meeting on October 24th, 1944. Sadly, late. I didn't know how to handle anger. I shouldn't say anger. I should say rage. I did not know how to handle rage. I came home one night and found my husband beating up my son. And I didn't know how to handle that. Once I got them apart and he passed out, I went into the kitchen and said, I'll show him, the son of a bitch. And I drank a whole glass of whiskey. And it took me 5-6 weeks to get back into AA. But I knew now I wanted it more than anything, because he was just making fun of AA. He kept saying, all you do is get drunk 2 weeks and sober 2 weeks. Because that's what I was doing that 5 or 6 weeks. I'd get sober and then I'd get off again, and sober and get off again. And I stayed sober for not a very good reason. I stayed sober because I was going to show him that AA was the most wonderful thing in the world, and I don't care how you start, as long as you keep coming. Because eventually you get so you have a little bit more common sense about this thing, and you'll recognize what a terrific program this is. And so I began the whole process of trying to grow in AA. And as I said, I was very slow. I couldn't receive the love. I'm not able to really and truly understand the third step prayer, which of course was so magnificent. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Because that's what I had to work at. I had to relieve myself of that bondage of self. I was so self-involved, so concerned about what people were going to think of me. It's just pathetic and desperate for approval. I didn't care who it was, the milkman, the laundry man, anybody, just approve of me, you know. Sick. Anyhow, after 6 years, I began to realize that I was not growing the way I wanted to grow. I was taking my husband's inventory instead of taking my own. He was drunk every night. I stayed sober. I was full of anger and hatred, and I was not, as I said, growing. I had finally begun to be a little bit more active in AA because I had been volunteering at the intergroup office for a couple of years. Once my youngest little girl went to nursery school, I could take a couple of days and do volunteer work at intergroup, which I loved doing. It made me feel so important. It was wonderful. I sat behind a desk with a telephone, and I could tell people all about Alcoholics Anonymous. It was wonderful for me because I learned I didn't know very much about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so from then on, I really had to begin to work the program and the steps and get myself a sponsor, which I had had initially, but he had moved out of town and I hadn't replaced him. And finally, I got a new sponsor and I began to really and truly try to grow in the AA program. And it got to the point where I knew I couldn't stay married any longer. The girls were very much upset. They were very unhappy with him. My son had gone off to college, so he wasn't around very much, but the girls were getting older, and he embarrassed them a couple of times in a terrible way. Anyhow, I finally got separated, and it was then that I began to really get going on the AA program. The first thing that happened to me was that I was asked to replace the coordinator or secretary of the intergroup office and take that job. And I was so grateful for it because with separation from Roger, I knew I would never get any money from him. After all, he was an alcoholic, and I never did get any child support. But anyhow, this little job helped. And I just loved working at the intergroup office, and I loved the whole aspect of AA. The recovery part of the program is so terrific, and I loved that, and I loved working the steps, and I loved seeing new people get sober, and I loved working with new people, and I loved the feeling of change in myself, how important it is, that change, that willingness, and finally coming to understand that the only thing I have to change is my attitude. That's what needs changing. I never could understand that at the beginning. I was great on change, but it was to change other people. You know, I'll change Roger, change everything else, but now I recognize the fact that the changes had to come in me and the willingness to make these changes, and I finally accepted and recognized the fact that what I had to change was attitudes. Attitudes about me, attitudes about you, reactions to things. I used to react. Roger knew how to punch my buttons. He'd punch my buttons and I'd go, yeah! And he'd think that was funny, so he'd punch them again. You know? And everybody's been doing that to me. And I was reacting. And I learned that I didn't need to react. You know, it's so easy sometimes to say, you may be right. I was always right, you know. And I learned in AA that I don't have to be. Even if I'm right, I can say to somebody else, you may be right. And that stops it. You can't argue with that, can you? It's a great little tool. And so I began to recognize this need for how to change. And attitudes were such an important thing. I mean, I had always hated myself because I was so tall. Well, I began to recognize the fact that being tall had its advantages. I could see parades. No. I could reach the top shelf. So I changed my attitude about being tall. I'm very happy I'm tall. Just easy. And this big nose of mine, oh, for years, any time I thought if I have enough money, I'll get a nose job. Boy, if I ever have enough money, I'll get a nose job. Never had enough money. Damn good thing I didn't hold my glasses up. And so I began to learn the importance of knowing who I was. Because in doing these things, I came to be aware of the fact that I didn't really know very much about the inner me. And I began to work the steps, and I began to understand this higher power. That was difficult. We used to call it the angle. I don't get the spiritual angle. And there isn't any angle. It's all spiritual. And if you look at the big book, it says so. Bill says that in the chapter of the agnostic. This is going to be a spiritual book. And if it's going to be a spiritual book, it's going to be a spiritual program. Not much doubt about that. But, of course, the thing I read in the book at the beginning was the stories. That's what I wanted to read. The hell with the chapters. That was too textbook for me. But I loved reading the stories, you know. And that gave me that identification too, which was very important to me at the beginning. But I didn't really understand a lot about the AA program at the beginning. I don't know, I guess 45-year-old, I forgot his name. I'm just, oh, terrible. He remembers the big book had a great big red and yellow cover. You could see it a mile away. It wasn't that spiritual blue that we have today that hides the title, you know. Oh, you could see it across the room. And I used to go home on the bus with this book and holding it up, you know. So you could see. Now, I wouldn't be reading the book. I'd be pacing the joint, you know, looking at people and looking at me. And I say to myself, isn't that fun? Those people, they're saying to themselves, look at that charming lady. Just think, she's an alcoholic. I didn't understand the program too well at the beginning. But I slowly began to change and slowly began to grow. And my son was away at college. I didn't have an opportunity to make the amends to him that I wanted to. He'd been very badly hurt, I guess. And every time I'd try to talk to him, he'd say, Mother, it's in the past. Let's not talk about it. And so I had to try and make amends. The only way I knew how with him, and that was to love him and to act as if I loved him and to share as much as I could of our love with the whole family. And once Roger moved out, we were able to do so much more of that. I had AAs come to the house. As Dale knows, we had poker parties on Saturday nights and so forth. And my little girls were there, and they used to fight terribly. And once in a while, they'd have a terrible fight, screaming and clawing at each other up and down the hall, and everybody would be like, I said, just forget it. Just leave them alone. Let them kill each other if they want to. Talking about sibling rivalry, it was terrible. And so I began to learn something about the wonderful fellowship that I had not had during the first 2 years on account of the stricture that I could not have any junks in my house, except him, of course. But anyway, so that was wonderful, and I began to see how that reacted on my daughters. They began to have that sense of love and fellowship, and they loved everybody. And it was very hard because everybody said, oh, call me by my first name. And they were being brought up to say Mr. So-and-so and Mrs. So-and-so. And it was difficult for them to adjust to turning around and calling him by his first name. You know, it was not polite. But anyhow, it was wonderful. And I knew that they had felt that because my little girl, the older one, came running home one day and said, Mommy, I know what I want to be when I grow up. And I said, what do you want to be, darling? And she said, I want to be a ballet dancer and a member of AA. She had felt that love. She had felt all that fellowship. She had seen the changes in me because she was old enough by then, 6 or 7 years old, to recognize that there was a difference in money. And of course, she didn't ever get to be a ballet dancer. But she got her wish. She's got 15 years of sobriety in AA. She didn't want the despair. She didn't want the desolation. She didn't want all the sadness that alcoholism brings. But she got it all. But as I said, she has 15 years of sobriety. And that same little girl had opened the door for me in another way because I had not really and truly known quite how to tell the children what I was doing when I was going off to these meetings at night. I didn't quite know how to explain AA to them or to tell them what I was doing. But one night, the same little daughter came home and said, Mommy, I've written a play. May I read it to you? And I said, of course, darling. You know, she said, well, it's a Thanksgiving play, and I've used the girls' names because we each are saying our own line, and it goes like this. And so she started reading and so forth, and she said, Diana says, we're going to go out for Thanksgiving dinner to my grandmother's house. And then Joni says, we're going to have my grandparents come to our house for Thanksgiving dinner. And then I say, we're going to have a very early dinner because my mommy has to go to an AA meeting. So that opened the door, and from then on we shared constantly the whole AA program. And I know that it meant something to both girls. That same little girl went off to boarding school, and after she'd gone, I had to send her. She was doing very poorly at home. She had a lot of problems. She had more problems than I had recognized at the time, which I've learned about in later years, and there's nothing I can do about them except pray. But she had written on her yellow pad, she put a line down it, and she'd written at the top on one side, things that are wrong with me, and on the other side, things are okay. And at 14 years old, she was trying to find out about herself using the AA program. She went to a psychiatrist for a little while. She was a clinical depressive, but none of us knew anything about clinical depression at that time. But anyhow, she's fine now. And so I began to enjoy living, understand what the book was all about. We absolutely insist on enjoying life, because I thought when I first got sober that I'd never have a good time again, that I'd never be able to go to a party, I wouldn't be able to talk to people, I wouldn't have any fun. And I had no idea that we were going to be able to enjoy life for the first time. You know, the word joy, I love the word joy, it's such a wonderful word. I found a wonderful definition of it, one which I try and use all the time. Joy is the expectancy of good. And I had always been expecting the worst. But that changes your whole attitude toward life if you are expectant of good. And I found that joy is a wonderful feeling. And I think we get it in AA. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. Happiness is another thing. For me, somehow, I feel that happiness is dependent a little bit more on external things. But the joy is that sense of oneness that we have with our Creator, that sense of oneness that we come to have in AA when we begin to find and understand this is a spiritual program, which is very hard for some of us. I didn't know how to make a decision to turn my life and will over until I knew what it was I was going to turn it over to. We don't have to know what we're going to turn it over to, but I didn't know that at first. And I made heavy weather in the third step. The first and second steps were easy. I knew that both of those I was absolutely sure of. The fourth step I got into, they said, don't stop, keep on going, but keep coming back to the third step until you got it, because you've got to get it. And I slowly began to understand what it was talking about. The spirit is not religion. The spiritual is not religious. And I had a feeling about religion that I didn't understand. But the sense of the spiritual began to open up, and I began to recognize there are so many things that we can learn about it. I mean, Matthew says, the Father within, do it for work. And Shakespeare said, there's a divinity within that shapes our ends. And I began to understand that there is, and the big book in that chapter to the agnostic says, the great reality within. And so I began to be able to grow spiritually. I began to understand that spirituality is the way we are. I began to recognize the fact that we really and truly, we've been saying on human beings trying to get spiritual, instead of which we must understand that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And that puts a kind of a different complexion on it. And so I began to grow, and I had the wonderful opportunity of going to work at the General Service Office. From the intergroup, I went up to the General Service Office. And it was a wonderful time to be there, because it was during the growing, exciting years to me. I'm sure any time would be a wonderful time to be there. But I felt it particularly at that time. It was the first General Service Conference was taking place. That time when AA was going to come of age, and we were going to grow and be responsible for our own activities and for our own lives, instead of depending on a board of trustees that sat in New York and really and truly was not in touch with the membership except through Bill. And Bill knew that he was going to eventually go. Bob had already gone. So to be there for that was exciting, and to see the growth of AA around the world. You know, we had literature in various places, England and Australia and New Zealand and South Africa, because they all had English literature. But then we began to get mail from South America by the ton in Spanish. And none of us had Spanish. We had to get Spanish literature. We had to have a Spanish secretary. And the whole overseas thing began to grow. So it was absolutely fascinating, and I just adored it. And I used to go look at places up on the map, you know, a letter would come from someplace and nobody'd know where it was, so I'd go look at the big maps we had out in the conference room, and I began to know our geography pretty well, and I began to, gee, it'd be great to go there. Boy, I'd love to see how that group's getting along. I'd love to go and see that group. And then our public relations began to get exciting and interesting. We had a man come from France who was to write a series of articles about Alcoholics Anonymous for a newspaper in Paris. And he did. He wrote these magnificent articles, but I was on the PR desk at that time. We used to rotate our assignments. And so it was my pleasure to take him around, introduce him to AA, take him to meetings, and so on and so forth, and talk to him and try and explain. And he went back and he wrote a wonderful series of articles and published a book called Avec des Alcooliques Anonymes, Avec meaning among the Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of a sudden, letters were pouring into a little English-speaking group in Paris from all over France. And we needed to get French literature. And then the same thing happened in Germany. and it's more Spanish. And so the whole thing was, to me, tremendously exciting. And to watch things suddenly developing on television and in newspapers and on movies that depicted Alcoholics Anonymous. So we were beginning to get into the public domain, and people began to understand what we were. Our anonymity had to be protected, but people aren't going to know about AA unless we tell them about it. And so I was excited by all of that, and it was just wonderful. And my son had gotten out of college, and he decided to get married. We had a lovely wedding for him, and he and his wife moved up to Schenectady with General Electric. He's now retired from General Electric, and he's done wonderfully well. He's 62 years old, my little boy. I became more and more enamored of the idea of getting to see AA around the world. I was dying to do it. And so one day I walked into the office and I thought I'd get myself beheaded by even broaching such a thing. But I said, wouldn't it be nice if we each of us had a leave of absence for a year? And know we had a job to come back to. Because I had to have that job, and I didn't think I was able to do anything else except AA, because I had no skills, hand actress for a while, never learned to type, couldn't do anything, it was dope. And so I had got to have a job to come back to, because my youngest daughter was still in college, and so forth. And I said, we could use the year any way we wanted to, but it would be nice if we could have it. And I thought they'd drum me out of the Corps. Instead of which, the idea took hold. Another girl went first, she'd been there longer than I had. And this was also in lieu of the fact that we did not have any pension plan. And I think they thought it was a way of making up to us the fact that there was no pension for the people who were working in the office. That changed eventually, so there is a pension plan now. But anyhow, they came in and said, okay, so I spent my year going around the world. And I went by myself. People would come and say, are you going alone? And I said, can you come with me? Oh, no. Well, then I'll go alone. I mean, if I was going to go, I had to go alone. And it was wonderful. I spent a whole year away from home. I was homesick sometimes. But how wonderful the AA program was. And I kept working at the promises. I kept seeing how the promises were being fulfilled in my life. How wonderful. To be able to meet situations that I had never before in my life come into contact with. Arriving in a place like Singapore where you don't know nothing. And getting through immigration and customs and doing all those things and finding a hotel. I mean, really and truly, I amazed myself. But I was having a ball. And I visited AA everywhere. And one of the things they kept saying to me was, you know, AA is the greatest export the United States has ever made. And I agreed with them. I think it is the greatest export. It's around the world. It's everywhere. And of course, that was in 65, 66. So now it's grown so. And if you were in Seattle, I'm sure you were excited and moved as I was when 75 national flags were carried down to the podium, including Russia, including Bulgaria, including Czechoslovakia, including Poland, including these countries behind the Iron Curtain. It was wonderful and exciting and thrilling. And that to me is what AA is all about. It's thrilling and exciting. I don't have to worry about enjoying life. Every day is a joy, if I let it be. Don't misunderstand me. Sometimes I talk better than I act. And sometimes the outside doesn't match the inside. I mean, the inside doesn't match the outside. So don't confuse that either. But it is. It's every day can be a challenge, yes. But we've been given the tools that we can face the challenge. We've been given the tools that we can enjoy living. And it is a joy when we have the right attitude. And I remember once, such a long time ago, every now and then I think about it and it makes me laugh. Because there was an office manager that I absolutely couldn't stand him. He hated me, and I hated him. You know, and I kept saying, that son of a gun. And somebody would say to me, well, act as if you love him. I said, what do you mean, act as if? Well, act as if you love him. I said, how can I act as if I love him when I hate the son of a bitch? They said, well, just act as if. I said, I'm not a hypocrite, for God's sake. I'm a very honest person. They said, just try it. So I began to try it. And about a year later, I said to one of these girls, well, Hank sure changed, hasn't he? It works. It works. That's the wonderful part about this program. It works. And of course, we sometimes add, if you work it, that's true. We do have to work it. I mean, I sat back there at the beginning and hoped that a magic wand was going to wave over me and that I was suddenly miraculous. Everything was wonderful. I didn't realize I had to work to get the benefits of the program, what it was all about. I didn't realize I was going to have to really immerse myself, no half measures, in order to make the changes that I found I had to make in order to become the kind of person I really was all the time but didn't know it. I think we have to accept that fact. I think we are born perfect. What happens to us, I don't know. But somewhere along the line, we get damaged, and we get self-obsessed, and we get afraid, and something hurts us, and we go on this wrong path. And of course, I'm sure we have some kind of a physical imbalance as far as alcohol is concerned. But addiction is a terrible thing. Addiction is a killer. And we have the tools in this fellowship with Alcoholics Anonymous to help any addiction. But let us not forget that Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. Let them borrow our 12 steps. Let them use the program for any other disorder. But let it be separate. Let it not be with us. We can all have other problems. We can all have terrible problems. But if we also want to stop drinking, we can use the AA program to solve those too, if we grow along spiritual lines. It's a wonderful program. And the love that we get here is so marvelous. And to go around the world, or to go across the United States, to go to these wonderful conferences and conventions, to go to a small home group, it doesn't make any difference. You know that there is love in that room because you can feel it, you can sense it. Sometimes it's so strong, you almost feel that it's touching you. And that, I think, is the message that we have. The message that we can love one another regardless of what the other person is like. We love that divinity within. We love that God person that is in each one of us. When we do that, then we sense that oneness we have with our Creator. And those are the days that are so wonderful. Those are the times when you really feel at peace. Those times when you feel at one with our source. That's why I was so unhappy. That's why I was so felt so separate and not a part of, because I felt separate from my source during those early years. And if we can find that sense of oneness, I think we know that we have a handle on what this is all about. And as I said in the first place, or as I said just a minute ago, love is the key. I remember very much, very clearly, a long time ago, not such a long time ago, 23 years, that's not so long in my lifespan, but anyway. When I got to Japan, I was trying to find an AA meeting. And I got to the church and I spoke to the lady in the library after some difficulty in finding it. I said, "Is there an AA meeting here?" And she said, "Yes, it's upstairs." I went upstairs, and there was a hallway. And at the end of the hall was a head, John. And there were three doors. So I looked at the first door, and it said, second grade. I listened, I didn't hear anything. I went to the first door. The door said, first grade. I listened, I didn't hear anything. The last door, it said, kindergarten. And I put my head, ear up to the door, and I heard, "Really, have we seen a person fail who was thoroughly fine?" And I thought to myself, that's it. That's it. We're a kindergarten. We don't come here. We may come here initially to stop drinking. But what we get when we get here is learning how to live. And how to live joyously, with caring, and with love. And I think I'll learn.